In the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, TNI and its allies are working to continue to bring you radical analysis of the most pressing issues of the day. Join us for our weekly webinars. We bring together excellent experts to discuss how this pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how this crisis must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live with dignity. This webinar explores who owns our data and why it matters, the relevance of data extraction for countries in the global south, and the impact of COVID-19. What strategies, structures, and institutions are needed at national and international levels to confront big tech and reclaim our data commons? What opportunities are available in this time of a pandemic to advance digital justice?
Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time it is where you are today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us for this webinar. My name is Ben Hayes. I'm your moderator for the day. I'm a fellow at the Transnational Institute. I've been involved with TNI for more than 10 years. My background is working on sort of counterterrorism, security, human rights issues. Since January of this year, I'm the co-director of AWO, which is a new data rights agency based in London and Brussels. AWO works in three areas at the intersection of law, technology, and policy. So we support progressive organizations in trying to shape public policies in the technology sphere. We help organizations who want to do the right thing with data, innovate responsibly, and apply best practices. And we enforce data rights laws through litigation, including cases such as the Cambridge Analytica prosecution, the ad tech case involving Google's use of the ad tech ecosystem, and micro-targeting by political parties in the UK. So I'll be joined in the discussion today by five wonderful panelists: Anita Gurumurthy, Ben Tarnoff, Carolyn Nevejan, I'm sorry if I've got that wrong, Carolyn, Nanjira Sambuli, and Vahini Naidu. And this webinar is co-organized by the Transnational Institute and IT for Change in India, and it's co-sponsored by the JustNet Coalition, AIDC in South Africa, and Focus on the Global South. And for those who don't know us, TNI is an international research institute that works closely with social movements to challenge inequality and injustice and to support transformative change around the world. So I'm happy to announce that this webinar is also being interpreted into Spanish. You can find the interpretation button below at the bottom of the screen. And so a huge thanks for our interpreters for making this possible. The format for the day is that we will hear a sort of short initial presentation from each of our five panelists. That'll last for about 7 minutes or so each. And then I'm then going to ask some follow-up questions before moving on some questions from the audience. And I'll give a chance for all panelists to respond. So you can share your questions at any time during the webinar via the Q&A option at the bottom of the screen. During the session, we'll also be sharing links to resources and further reading in the chat box. And you can also engage there. But be aware the questions in the chat will be answered by other participants and not by the panelists themselves. If you want to add thoughts on social media, please do so. We'd love that. Just use the hashtag TNI webinars. I guess I'll just share a few thoughts on sort of, you know, what makes the issues around big tech so sort of important in the current moment. And you know, coming from myself, someone who's worked on issues around state and corporate power, around security and surveillance for several decades, I think what the COVID-19 crisis really crystallizes is the intersection between corporate power, state power, technology, and rights. And, you know, the last decade was really characterized in this space by two things, you know, Edward Snowden's revelations in the first part of the 2010s, and the extent of government surveillance and the global state of that surveillance infrastructure. I think the last few years have been characterized by a sort of growing understanding of the power of big tech companies, the business model of surveillance capitalism, and the way that's changing, you know, almost every element of social and material life, or has the potential to change almost every element of social and material life in ways we don't yet really understand. What does COVID-19 do? I think it's most stark because it seems to marry these two things in really quite stark ways. State surveillance on the one hand, corporate power and surveillance capitalism on the other. And I'm speaking to you from the UK now. But if we look at the role of, you know, technology in the government's response, we now have private companies like Palantir and Google at the heart of our National Health Service, shaping the government's response to COVID-19 and giving it access to data about our populations in quite incredible ways. And, you know, we're also talking about things like immunity passports and, you know, government access to the data in these COVID tracing apps in ways that, frankly, quite frighten the data rights community. Some of these issues TNI has already addressed in a previous webinar on state security, surveillance and data. And I believe you can see all of the previous webinars. They're on the TNI website. In this webinar, we're going to focus specifically on the sort of big data and corporate power angles of this and how we take on the tech titans. And some of the key questions that we're hoping to answer in this session are, who owns our data and why does that matter? What are the issues at stake for developing countries? Because obviously this is playing out very differently in different parts of the world. What has been the impact of COVID-19 in terms of data enclosure and the power of big tech? And then finally, what are the strategies, approaches, structures that we may need to reclaim ownership over our data, whether as individuals or collectively? And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Ben Tarnoff. Ben Tarnoff is a tech worker, a writer, founding editor of the excellent Logic magazine, a brilliant print magazine about technology that publishes three times a year. He is also the co-editor of the forthcoming Voices from the Valley, Tech Workers Talk About What They Do and How They Do It. And that'll be published in October of this year. And his writing has appeared in The Guardian, Jacobin, The New Republic, and various other places. So thank you very much for joining us, Ben, and welcome. I hope that you're going to lay out for us some of the context of why data has become such a profitable resource and why big tech is seeking to control ownership of it. So over to you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for that introduction. And thanks to everyone for joining us. I'm really excited about this conversation. So the title of this webinar is Taking on the Tech Titans. I thought I'd start just briefly talking a little bit about how the present crisis around COVID is intensifying the power of those titans. Ben alluded to this a bit in his opening remarks, and how that intensified power in turn will have major consequences for data enclosure and data extraction. So at the moment, roughly half of the world's population is currently living under some form of lockdown order. Now, of course, many millions of people across the world can't afford to stay at home because they have to go out and make a living however they can. But globally, a substantial share of humanity, perhaps an unprecedented share of humanity, is staying home. One consequence of this that we've seen all over the world is a sharp increase in internet usage. So anywhere a lockdown order has been implemented, internet usage has grown. To give an example, in January, when China locked down Hubei province, which is home to Wuhan, the original epicenter, mobile broadband speeds dropped by more than half because of network congestion, because everyone was using the internet at home. And we've also seen similar drops in speeds across different countries whenever stay-at-home orders have been implemented and thus led to spikes in traffic. To give you a couple more numbers to put that in perspective, in Italy, which of course has had one of the highest death tolls in the world, tragically, home internet usage has increased 90%. And globally, internet traffic is about 25 to 30% higher than usual since the crisis began. So relatedly, as you might expect, we've also seen surging use of cloud services, right? Because all of these folks are using the internet more and more. So the infrastructure that sustains the services that people are using is being taxed more and more by those users. To give you a couple more numbers here, I promise this isn't all numbers, but I think it's useful to throw a few of those out at the beginning. As of late April, Synergy Research estimated that the cloud industry has already spent more money on data centers so far this year than in all of 2019, and that Amazon and Microsoft, who are two of the largest cloud providers, have some 50 new data centers in the works globally. And that's wild because each of those data centers can be very, very large. These hyperscale data centers are absolutely massive. So clearly, there's surging internet use, surging demand for cloud services. Of course, another important element here, which Ben alluded to, are new opportunities and new demand for more invasive state and corporate surveillance. And during the crisis, this has really run the gamut from contact tracing with cell phone location data, which has been particularly aggressive in East Asian countries, to monitoring body temperatures with thermal imaging, tracking the infected with facial recognition, which is something that's being explored in the United States by Clearview AI, as well as enforcing social distancing guidelines in the workplace with wearable devices that track workers around the workplace. Of course, another element of surveillance has been greater surveillance of protesters and people engaging in any type of dissent or oppositional activity, particularly as the uprisings take place across the world in the wake of George Floyd's murder at the hands of Minneapolis police. So now that we've set that scene a little bit, I want to discuss briefly what they do with that data. So we've talked a bit about why COVID will accelerate digitization, why the pandemic will give corporations and governments more opportunities to create more data about us and the environments we inhabit. But why are they doing that in the first place? What's the point of gathering all of this data? And I think that's really important because sometimes we'll talk about, you know, who owns our data without discussing why they own our data and why it's useful to them. So when we talk about the tech titans, when we talk about the possibility of reclaiming our digital commons, we need to understand how those commons are being produced in the first place and for what purpose. And I think in order to do that successfully, we need to talk about capitalism. So as long as capitalism has existed, data has helped it grow, right? You have the boss watching how workers work and rearranging them to be more efficient. This is a good example of how surveillance has long generated information that is then used to improve productivity. Famously, in the early 20th century, Frederick Winslow Taylor made systematic surveillance of the productive process a key part of what he called scientific management, a set of widely influential ideas about how to increase industrial efficiency that is still visible in industrial processes all over the world. So data is useful for capitalism. That's not new. What's new is the scale and the significance of data, thanks to breakthroughs in information technology. Digitization makes data more abundant because it becomes much easier to create, to store, and to transmit. You can slap a small device on almost anything and stream data from it. A shipping container, an assembly line, a gas turbine, the wrist of a worker in a factory or a warehouse or an office. So the ability to extract information from the productive process in order to optimize it has reached a level of sophistication way beyond it's ever been before. But crucially, and I think this is really crucial, observing the productive process is not the only way we create data. More broadly, we create data whenever we do anything that is mediated or monitored by a computer. And that encompasses a growing number of activities in more and more of the world. So you don't have to be a worker in a factory to have data being made about you. And in fact, just because you're not directly using a computer or you're not aware of it, doesn't mean the data isn't being created about you with or without your knowledge or consent. Now, of course, no single technology contributes more powerfully to digitization than the internet, because it contributes to the flow of data and it creates more and more of it. And everything we do online leaves a trace. And this is partly why corporations are so eager to put more and more of our lives online in order to create more and more traces. So at one level, when we talk about big data, we mean literal bigness, more data, bigger data sets. But big data also means that the data can be made more meaningful, that it can yield valuable lessons about how people or processes behave or how they're likely to behave in the future. Now, this is true for a few different reasons. It's partly because we have more data. It's partly because we have faster computers. It's partly because developments in fields like machine learning have given us better tools for analysis. Machine learning in particular is a powerful tool for pattern recognition, where you can train it on data, the system learns the pattern, and then it can recognize that pattern in the future. For instance, faces. Now I'm running out of time here, but I just want to say that the bottom line is that big data is driving the digitization of everything, because any piece of information, when combined with other pieces and analyzed or interpreted in mass, may reveal actionable knowledge about the world. It might teach a manufacturer how to make a factory more efficient. It might tell an advertiser what kind of things you might buy. It might help an intelligence analyst map your movements, or a drone operator decide where to drop a bomb. Briefly, this is why I think digitization is becoming as important to capitalism as financialization was during and after the 1970s. On the one hand, it offers a new engine of capital accumulation. On the other hand, it gives states new tools of social control to help order populations to be more useful for the purposes of accumulation, to manage redundant, rebellious, and racialized populations. And again, I think that COVID-19 is likely to intensify these developments. I'll pause there. Sorry for a little bit longer than I'd expected.
No problem at all, Ben. That was great. Thanks so much. And I think from, you know, from my own point of view, just sort of that realization that, you know, what sort of power are we putting in the hands of corporations when they can know more about societies than those societies know about themselves, I think really, you know, gets to the heart of what's in front of us. So with that, our next speaker will take us into how big tech, largely concentrated in the North, is seeking to consolidate its power at the expense of development in the global South. We're very grateful to be joined by Vahini Naidu. Vahini is currently a deputy director in the Trade Policy Negotiations and Cooperation Division at the South African Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, it's the DTIC. Since 2009, she's been engaged in international trade negotiations, specializing in trade and services, focusing on multilateral and regional trade negotiations. Currently, she is covering e-commerce, digital trade policy, and negotiating issues in the African Union, BRICS, Commonwealth, G20, SADC, UNCTAD, and the WTO. She's currently a member of an interdepartmental task team that is developing South Africa's national data framework. South Africa's actually been at the forefront of opposing efforts by big tech to change trade rules, regardless of its impact on development, poverty, and human rights. So we're very glad to hear from her perspective and experience. So Without further ado, I'll hand over to you, Bahini.
Hi, good afternoon, good day, good morning. Thank you very much to the organizers and to all the participants. So very briefly, I just wanted to give you an introduction. I know that there's a perspective that the WTO is dead, but contrary to popular belief, I think it's important to clarify that there's a lot of activity taking place in the WTO. Even though one major developed economy has actively sought to dismantle the appellate body, which is the enforcement arm of the WTO, at the same time, they are also aggressively advocating for digital trade rules in a trade agreement in the WTO. The development agenda on eliminating agricultural subsidies and intellectual property rights, etc., is very much still on the agenda. And the pandemic has reinforced the importance of this agenda for developing countries, especially from a food security and industrial policy point of view. I also wanted to point out that advanced economies are pushing their own reform agenda and negotiations in the WTO by aggressively pursuing rulemaking on e-commerce, investment, transparency, and trying to eliminate any special preferences for developing and least developed countries. These are all very contentious issues, and they do not enjoy the consensus of the membership. The relevance of the WTO has also been reinforced by the rise in unilateral measures adopted by some advanced economies, and therefore the importance of the WTO has increased for developing countries who do not have the legal capacity to justify their policies. So just coming more to the topic and how this matter is being forcefully introduced and discussed and negotiated in the WTO is to just say that since July 2016, the US had tabled a submission in the WTO trying to refocus the existing exploratory work program on e-commerce to begin to examine the linkages between digital trade and economic development. Now, this submission had listed 16 seemingly innocuous trade-related policies that they wanted countries to adopt. And very soon emerged a series of proposals by advanced economies, and this was suddenly branded as e-commerce for development, but there were no development rules in any of these proposals. Since 2018, a group of members have decided amongst themselves that they want to negotiate multilateral rules on e-commerce. And currently, 84 members out of the 164 members in the WTO membership have become formal signatories to these plurilateral negotiations on e-commerce. It's very critical to point out here that there's been a large influence from the International Chamber of Commerce and big technology firms and corporations involved in advancing their interests in the negotiations. A common theme in these negotiations has been to pursue a deregulatory approach to digital trade. In other words, the current text strongly favors rules that leave all the discretion to companies on how they use and share technology, data, how they treat and commercialize data, with a very, very minimal role for state intervention. And currently in the proposed text, there are also very limited exceptions, which have proven through WTO jurisprudence to be extremely difficult and onerous to prove, especially for developing countries. Now, I just need to make very clear that even though these negotiations are branded as e-commerce, it's actually de facto exceeding far beyond what policymakers would classify as traditional e-commerce. So it touches on things like internet governance, ICT matters, ICT products and services, technology, digital trade, etc. Some of the demands from big tech include rules such as you shall not impose any customs duties, fees, or other charges on a digital product transmitted electronically. Things like electronic authentication, you must leave it to companies and consumers to decide how secure their electronic transactions should be. And as we know, consumers aren't really in a position to ensure this. Other rules include things like no member shall restrict or prohibit the cross-border transfer of information, including personal information, by electronic means if this activity is for the conduct of a business. Members are required to commit to ensuring cross-border data flows to facilitate trade in the digital economy. Another rule, no member shall require the transfer of or access to source code software or to an algorithm expressed in that source code. Another proposal is to open up government data. So as you can see, these are extremely broad proposals, and one has to ask whether the WTO is in fact the right forum to be discussing these issues. South Africa, the majority of the African group, several WTO members, including India, have not joined this agreement, and they have expressed extreme difficulties with the manner in which these negotiations have been conducted. South Africa, for example, believes that these multilateral rules on e-commerce and digital trade is premature. We've seen several challenges emerge from the current reading of the rules. The first is that we do have a range of unanswered technical questions related to the ownership, control, management of data that will be very critical for evidence-based policymaking. We have other questions such as whether the gains outstrip the costs, or whether the net value generated is captured in the domestic economy, or whether it's flowing out, whether there are employment gains or not. There's a whole lot of policy and technical questions that we're still analyzing from a South African perspective. Another reason is that the content of many of these current proposals for rules in this area suggest a different trajectory than the one such as inclusive and equitable economic development. For example, we are seeing these rules that would permanently constrain governments' ability to manage our digital transformation by imposing a range of prohibitions across the board on customs duties, local content, localization, transfer, data flow, source code disclosure, etc. These rules, as it stands, appear to be designed to lock in the advantages now enjoyed by firms and countries that already lead the digital economy. And therefore,
I'm going to give you the 1 minute warning there, Vahini.
Okay. And therefore, many of the proposals that are aimed at facilitating digital trade, in our view, would simply reinforce existing imbalances in this trade. I also just wanted to point out that a lot of these rules will constrain developing countries' ability to build digital capacities. You know, we're seeing that there is a very, very huge asymmetry in the development of e-commerce globally. You know, with 90%, with two countries accounting for 90% of the market value of 70 of the largest platforms. And I think there's a list of links that I've shared where you can find all this information. And these asymmetries are extremely problematic. And the digital divide, at least the way we're seeing it now, it will determine which countries will recover from the pandemic. And this divide, the digital divide, will reinforce the social divides in the world. Essentially, and just to sum up, I just want to point out that it's critical that at the heart of this is data. And we know that digital capacities are needed to build productive capacities, especially for developing countries, for sustainable and inclusive growth. But we also know that at the heart of this is data, and therefore this big push by big tech to liberalize data is extremely problematic And there really needs to be more focus on what's happening in the WTO and for developing countries to begin to develop their frameworks. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vahini. And that's certainly, you know, super illustrative of two of the things we've been grappling with at TNI over the last 30, 40 years, which is, you know, the use of these multilateral fora to push corporate-friendly frameworks, and just the mismatch between the power of big corporates and civil society to push back. I would now like to introduce Anita Gurumurthy. Anita has been really instrumental in actually putting this webinar together, so we're very grateful to her for that. Anita is a founding member and executive director of IT for Change, where she leads research collaborations and projects in relation to the network society with a focus on governance, democracy, and gender justice. Anita, would you be able to expand a little on what Vahini has shared and some of your thoughts about what needs to be done to confront big tech, right? What would it mean, as far as you see it, for us to reclaim our rights to data? Over to you.
Thank you. There are two key aspects of capitalist production that are different from what was even 10 years ago. And this is what I really would like to do, you know, to bridge the background that Ben laid out and the specifics that Vahini pointed out. The first aspect is that data has become a valuable resource, and artificial intelligence or digital intelligence, which is based on data, is an important factor of production today. We have an entirely new way of economic organization, a new value chain, if you will, which comes from how production and market exchange are managed through insights from data. Data is being collected, sorted, arranged, and processed all the time. And there's a huge industry out there for this, annotating data, the startups building algorithms, etc. This is the industry for intelligent production that is defining what we call the digital economy. And this is not just about a sector in the economy anymore. The data business is cross-sectoral. So let me clarify this with an example. Companies acquire or buy stakes in other companies based on a long data game to seize the market. They take a horizon view of how to expand their dominions based on data marriages. No different from how the royal family has decided to fix marriages of sons and daughters based on political economic considerations. This game was clearly evident when Bayer acquired Monsanto to marry pharmaceutical data with soil and seed data so that it can control more than one third of the agri-input market. Or Amazon acquired Whole Foods to marry its online commerce with a new and booming offline market for organic foods. Data has become key to modeling the entire supply chain. What you will produce and how, to where, when, and how you will sell what you produce. And data-based intelligence determines productivity in the digital economy. This is the new capitalist model based on data value chains. The second aspect of capitalist production in these times is about who controls these new supply chains. So who holds the reins? And this has already been mentioned. Platform companies are the lead firms who control data value chains. They are the wise ones, or those upon whom wisdom was thrust by circumstances. Companies who used the internet to build their initial business, but soon discovered the magic power of data to develop the prescience to model not just their own business processes, as Ben pointed out, but the market itself. Platform firms dominate the global business landscape today, capturing a lion's share of market capitalization, nearly 60%. And their power is only growing, and growing at breathtaking speed. As Jack Ma said in some interview once, it took the Alibaba empire 15 years to achieve the numbers that Walmart achieved in 60. Now, we all believe, and rightly so, that in respect of data society, the biggest problem is that our personal information is held hostage by big tech companies, and that our behavior is being controlled through such enclosure. But the story is much more diabolic. It's about how information about us and about the world and its phenomena and artifacts is combined into raw material for capitalism to create and expropriate value for itself. So yes, there is the privacy angle here, the deep invasion of our lives, but this is just one side of the story. The story really is about how such invasion translates into exploitation. And injustices need to be understood for their mechanics. The first step to confront the fictions and fake news that concern data is where we need to head. The first fake news is that data is non-rivalrous. That is, my consumption of data will not affect your consumption. The supply will be unlimited. But this is not true. In reality, data as a unitary piece of information is meaningless. Data acquires valency only when it's relational or is seen in relation to other data. That is why data is a system resource. It enables connections to be made at different depths and layers of things in a system. And big tech companies who got there 15 to 20 years ago were able to build these ecosystems of connections thanks to the network effects of the internet. They became the winners who took all. This means that the data they have is locked up and is not available to others. The data from which meaning and value can be generated for not only economic, but also social and public purposes is today rivalrous. The irony is that IP regimes in intellectual property do not recognize ownership rights in data. That is, data does not come with any authorship or creator rights, but big tech is simply able to pilfer data and extract profit from it. And since algorithms are not allowed to be patented, companies like Amazon have twisted the patents regime by showing rather simple algorithms as business method innovations. So, despite the de jure absence of property rights in data, what we are witness to today is the de facto enclosures of data by big tech. I'll just conclude this part of my intervention with the second fake news about data. The second fake news is about data flows. We are told that the data economy presents tremendous opportunities through free data flows across borders. Bangladeshi data will go to the US as easily as US data will go to Bangladesh. There is, after all, thanks to the internet, a brand new frictionless economy. But the truth of the matter is that the data economy, very much like the knowledge economy, is far from frictionless, considering that the early movers, Google, Facebook, Alibaba, were able to capitalize on network advantage and the ability to expand markets at near zero costs on the internet. Their platform infrastructure became the apparatus par excellence to gather and hold data and build data-driven economies of scale. It's hardly possible for a Bangladeshi firm today to build even a small unicorn that can attract VC funding, let alone another Google. In the intelligence economy, where insights coming from data are cornered by a few firms, market structures grow to become unjust. 75% of the cloud computing market, 75% of patents in blockchain, and 50% of spending on IoT is shared by US and China. And I don't have the kind of bureaucratic compunctions that Vahini might have in mentioning the names of these economies. If data did not flow freely, the grand economic rents that the big firms are getting will simply stop. And this is why the major powers want to preserve the fiction that data cannot be claimed as a resource that belongs to people and their jurisdictions. But how do we reclaim data for the commons is something that I'd like to come in and speak about at the next round.
Thanks, Anita, and we'll certainly make sure you have the chance to do that. We're now going to take a look at the role of big tech in the city and some of the ways that cities are trying to look at different models of using data that support democracy and citizenship control. And to learn more about this, we're joined by Caroline Nevejan, who I hope is going to correct my awful pronunciation of her surname, a researcher and designer who has been involved with the Emerging Network Society and Digital Culture since the 1980s. Caroline is currently Chief Science Officer of the City of Amsterdam, where TNI is based, exploring ways of bringing together city officials with researchers to build what she calls the information architecture for democracy. She's going to talk about both the challenges cities like Amsterdam face from the power of big tech, as well as the alternative approaches that cities and communities can take. So over to you, Caroline.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Jess, could you put my slides on, please? Yeah, thank you. Yes. So thank you very much for inviting me. And I'm so happy to be in your company and to hear you talk about the things you talk, because in the old days, it was a more balanced flow of information. This was 70s and 80s. This was still the media of television. That this whole big company is taking over the world is really terrible. But Jess, can you give me a new slide, please? Yeah. What I want to point out, not only the bad news, because in principle, the fact that we have this new media also allows us to get a new understanding of the world. For a long time, human were the measure of all things. And then we got into measurable human beings, so we were able to measure blood pressure, distance, all those kind of things. But now, because of data and internet, we have a measurable humankind. We have an image of the planet from the perspective of the moon. We can know what many people feel and think and see. So there's also a potential that we need to pay attention. Yes. However, in our cities especially, we have now gone into complex systems. And these complex systems means that we now live in communities of systems and people where systems have maybe even more agency than large amounts of the people who live in the city. And this raises the question of trust. How do you design for participation? How do you design for surveillance? And this new meta design paradigm, really in every step you take on the way, you just don't take a picture. The picture immediately becomes a form of participation or a form of surveillance. And this is what we hardly know how to talk about even. What we see is that with the data and the big companies, like some of the previous speakers already pointed to it, the financial economy used to be 1/3 and 2/3 was the sharing economy, according to Lawrence Lessig, the guy who invented the Creative Commons. But what we see in the last decades that the big companies have invaded the private lives and invaded the sharing economy, financializing so many elements of our lives that were never had anything to do with money at all. And what we see in the city, if this is a sort of like a children's drawing that I make in my PowerPoint play, is where you can see that on the one hand, there are all these data of the people that are taken by the big companies. And on the other hand, you see that people pay with Bitcoin for buildings, for houses. There's a whole market that we're also not involved as a city. And a city is a place. We are dependent on the taxes. We need to build the schools, the hospitals, the roads. So our participants need to be here. Our information need to be here. Our data, we are our data. So they need to be here. It's our locality. And what we see is that on the one hand, by grabbing our personal data, and on the other hand, introducing a financial system that's completely uncontrollable, that does not allow for tax paying, we are making the cities really, how do you call it, victims of greed. Yes. And then you see this slide where we took a long time to develop it with some colleagues, where you can see that on the one hand, as a city, we have way too much data on the privacy sector. So we lost our privacy. And because we lose our privacy, we cannot doubt, we cannot change our opinion, and democracy is at stake. On the other hand, you see that we have way too little data about what's happening in the companies. And that's where the whole justice and the justice is at stake. Yes. So here are two elements. But how do I, as an individual, deal with this? And on the one hand, you see a lot of effort in all over the world, also in India, for example, where people invest in creating digital commons, making new software, the Linux community, the open source community, the blockchain community, where people think if we just make new architectures, we can beat the tech titans. On the other hand, you see that people protect themselves with crypto. So you try to make your own life outside of this world. And I really want to point attention to all the people who look here, to the Center for Investigative Journalism. I used to be involved with that. They offer great summer schools where you can learn how to protect yourself from bad tech companies. However, and they give big, great, great conferences. That's really where technology and journalism came together. They supported WikiLeaks. They supported Snowden. These are the people who know how to create best a space where there's a limit to how far they can invade. And they also teach and develop, and with maybe with some of you, new strategies to unveil truths that are hidden from us. So there is this tension on the one hand, and this is a very old debate in my perception, but on the one hand that we do more crypto, and on the other hand, we do more public domain. And in the end, you cannot make the choice, but you see that legal instruments, like in Europe, we now have GDPR, the privacy law, it's very important. It changes how business is going. It changes the data market. It changes how companies behave, how cities and governments behave. So I want to point out that there are instruments like the Right to Information Act. It has changed so much in so many countries. It's now jeopardized because of digital technologies, because they are not designed for transparency. But we cannot give up. So between this tension between cryptography and public domain, there is this tension. So where do we go from here? Yes. And then I think I want to work and find new ways to use this data potential, because it's also imagination. So we say, I work with Pinar Safkatli here, one of my PhDs, where we look at how rhythm can be a way for us, people living in the city, to understand our own life better with each other. Because we are rhythm, nature is rhythm, social life is rhythm, culture is rhythm, and it can maybe help us to tune. Yes. We have to realize that it's really not all about data. It's also about our environment. So I work with Deborah Solomon on the idea of multi-species urbanism. First design ecology before you design the people in it, let alone the technology in it. So going back to new ways of producing the environment around us really requires attention. Yes. That also goes for how we deal with each other. Diversity, I mean, with the Black Lives Matter everywhere on the planet, this is so fundamental that we design for diversity. And like the big techs, they all design for the same kind of people. Yes, we are the same kind of people, but we need diversity to thrive. Yes. And then you see that as Amsterdam, we now have this new application area where we really put a lot of effort. We have decided in the municipality to become a circular city. We use the model of Kate Raworth, the donut economics, where you can make a relation between the social and the ecological, and between the local and the global. And it also allows us, on the right side, you see, to make a portrait from us as a city. And you see, we do really bad on the global ecological side of our lives. So this is a way to start reflecting about how we operate and how our own footprint develops. And then we got back. So we make this very nice magazine, Values for Survival. Please download it. We start, it's a year-long research program. If you want to participate, please contact me. And then we go back to the last slide, which is the beginning slide. Yes, Jess? Yes, go back to the first slide, which is that climate change that we are faced with, please go back to the slide before, climate change needs a new awareness of us. And the fact that we can perceive humankind, that we can perceive our actions, it can also become a tool for our survival. And let's not give up imagination because of tech giants misbehaving. We just got to be the small David that kills the Goliath. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn. I think I speak for all at TNI when I say it's wonderful to hear that ideas that have started with activists and in social movements are now being embraced by city planners and others. So finally, I would like to introduce Nandjira Simbuli. She's a researcher, policy analyst, and advocacy strategist who works to understand the intersection of information and communications technology, its adoption with governance, media, entrepreneurship, and culture. Nandjira is a commissioner on the Lancet and Financial Times Global Commission, Governing Health Futures 2030, and a board member at the New Humanitarian Development Gateway Digital Impact Alliance. Nangira led policy advocacy to promote digital equality and access to and use of the web at the World Wide Web Foundation over the past 5 years. And in addition to other advisory roles, Nangira also served as a panel member on the United Nations Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Digital Cooperation and as a deputy on the UN Secretary General's High-Level Panel for Women's Economic Empowerment. So with that fantastic CV, Nangira, I was wondering if you could reflect on some of what has been shared before, and particularly what you think the response of international civil society should be. What is it that we need to do? What do we need to consider? What should our strategies be?
Thanks, Ben, and hi, everyone. So I think I'll get us set off on the reflection side of things, and I'm hoping to speak here to some strands that cut across and that hopefully help us all in what we think of international civil society or progressives or the left on that global or international level. So what we plan to do or what we're doing, what we will do, but also what we must stop doing. First and foremost, we need to consider and really accommodate the diversity of perspectives on data, on values like privacy in the digital economy, and really situate them in the historical, political, and very nuanced contexts all around that these digital developments are finding across the so-called Global South. I'll speak of the Global South, but please consider it a stand-in for the diverse and marginalized majority across the globe who are not a homogenous lot either. So how we study their understanding of these issues, how we measure our progress and success here is the first thing I'll reflect on. For instance, we can advocate for laws and regulations protecting data, protecting our privacy, and this we can consider them successes when we put them in place, or we see countries putting them in place. That said, they may not necessarily be reflective or representative of how citizens from those parts of the world perceive these issues. And more often than not, these successes then end up just being tick box measures taken on by many developing countries or Global South countries to quell the noise from the internationals or in the international community. Secondly, on the actions and recommendations that we put forth on countering or reforming the status quo, sometimes they can be impractical in how we put them forth, and sometimes even come across as callous for most developing countries. A good example here is the call for the delete Facebook example. I found it curious that that gained traction, and it was almost got a moment there that it came across as this moral imperative, delete Facebook. But it is actually quite impractical for so many people across the world. You have to remember that Facebook and its family of apps and technologies is the internet for so many people. And if you just want to see one very interesting example is look up how WhatsApp is used in Brazil. There's a great feature of that in the new publication, Rest of World, that shows you if you remove that from the communities in the favelas there, what are you actually removing from them as far as using these resources to shape their realities? So there are alternatives we propose to reclaiming our data commons or reclaiming the digital space altogether could use some contextualization and could use some humility in how we put them forth to create room for discussion on other ways those who cannot quite adopt what we mainstream in our discussions can bring, because there are so many people for whom the entire internet experience is an enclosure altogether. And this is very important because developing markets are the greatest market growth potential or capture, really, trajectory for the digital and data economy. Now, for many of us who are on this side of things, these assaults are coming from private sector, they're coming from governments, whether you call them Western, Eastern, all of them are making our parts of the world the next geopolitical battlefront. We are the prized possessions. I saw somebody talking about we being users of in the digital economy. I think it's even more than that. If we really reflect on the relationship that is being set up, we are not even users anymore. That's what we're sold, but really we are slaving to give context, to bring so much of ourselves to be datafied. And what we're getting in return is really pittance. So it really is an onslaught of assaults, however you slice it. So in this configuration, I think the international civil society must not repeat the same mistakes we've seen before. This, you know, still speaking or advocating and working for us, in those we left behind in that sense, And rather than stepping aside and really creating room to amplify and give a spotlight to those observing and mobilizing on the ground. I usually call this the Columbusing problem that's still pervasive today. Many folks in developing countries or in marginalized communities have been following how these issues are developing in their context, and they've been speaking to them for years. But this is not often reflected in what becomes the international movement, internationalized movement, and calls for alternatives or pushing back against big tech and others. And right now with the Black Lives Matter movement, we've seen, for example, IBM's statement that they'll stop developing facial recognition technology. The wins really should go to the group of AI researchers, you know, who are, happen to be women of color, who have been speaking and beating the drum on this for such a long time. Now, they may not have gotten the book deals to write the books that we cite today about this issue, but they've been there from the get-go, and they've probably been put as footnotes in some of the sources that we tend to amplify as the, you know, the great moment and the moment of Columbus, these issues. I think the international civil society has a moral imperative to bypass that. So that we need to, when we speak to values and principles like diversity, solidarity, as a currency that not everybody is using, we must be careful not to seem as though we are also having a selective application and enforcement as international civil society. So the justice we're seeking ultimately here, it starts with how we order our and reform our houses. I think it's really a tragedy and will be a tragedy if we have people, the marginalized majority again, fighting the onslaught from private sector, fighting the onslaught from governments, their own and these international ones, and then also having to fight internationalized or institutionalized civil society. We really need to start walking the talk. So we need, ultimately in closing, to have a lot more folks reflect on this, accept this reality, marinate in that discomfort, and then we can start rebuilding from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Nandira. I was reflecting while you were talking on, you know, some of the response among, you know, the digital rights community as it was then to the Snowden revelations. And there was this sort of appeal to everybody about how you should be outraged at this because, you know, the government has access to all your communications, but, you know, very little regard to how this was actually playing out in very racialized terms and that, you know, the victims of this particularly pernicious system, you know, were victims of a structural complex in counterterrorism, and were often missing from the stories of why and how we should have been pushing back against that. So I've been asked at this point to sort of just reflect on where we've got to and then field some questions that have been coming in from the people who've joined us on this webinar. Thanks so much for that. I guess, you know, we've had a sort of high level introduction to you know, how this technology works in the big data space and why data matters. We've heard how big tech has tried to shape global rules that favor corporate globalization. We've learned that sort of platform capitalists don't just enjoy monopolies over the information we provide them with. They can also determine how and where value is created by data in the economy and society more broadly. And more importantly, who gets to participate in this, right? We've heard the kind of practical challenges that municipalities face and the way in which, you know, democratic or progressive cities might embrace technology. And we've heard a bit about, I think, you know, just the complexity of some of this and the need for strategies that can be put into a local context and don't simply just sort of copy paste something that may have seemed applicable in one context to another and think about what it is that different people in different parts of the world need from a sort of a new data settlement, if you like. So with that, I'm going to go back to each of our participants, some with questions from the floor, as it were, and some with my own questions. I'm going to start with Ben. I'm going to ask you all to speak for up to 5 minutes. And I guess, this is a question that we had from the floor. How can we challenge the big data power of big tech? Can we ensure that within tech business models, social good is not always subordinated to shareholder interests? And then I was going to augment that with a question of my own. It was just something I was thinking about as you were talking. And I think, you know, one of the most interesting things about the sort of the tech space is that capitalism, you know, doesn't just own the data, it owns the infrastructure as well, like in its entirety, this huge global infrastructure. And so can we deal with the ownership of data if we don't also address the ownership of the infrastructure? So I'll let you take those as you see fit. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, those are really great and difficult questions. You know, I think this point about we can't think about the data without the infrastructure is an important one and connects to a broader point, which is that the metaphors that we use to talk about this process are imperfect. And that's inevitable because abstractions are hard and they're always leaky. But when we talk about things like data extraction, data commons, data enclosure, the metaphors suggest that there's something out there called data that is then extracted like oil or enclosed like land, and value is made from it. But in fact, that's not how it works. Data is something that is actively constructed. And that construction begins at the very beginning when the data is made. So a camera that observes us, an algorithm that observes our mouse movements around a website, whatever it is, they're observing particular parts of us and organizing that in a particular way. And that reflects a very intentional, purposeful process. When we move to the next stage of the pipeline, what in machine learning is often called data wrangling, which is turning raw data into the type of data that is useful for analytics. You know, data scientists spend most of their time on this process. The actual running machine learning models is a very small percentage of what folks do compared to this data wrangling. And a lot of this is known as feature engineering, which is isolating and extracting particular attributes of the data that will have maximal predictive value for whatever you're trying to predict. So that's all to say that, to your initial point, Ben, I think we have to absolutely think of these questions as not just data floating out there as something that is being hoovered up by corporate and state actors and something that we could take back and use for our purposes, but is completely intertwined with these infrastructures that create the data, that organize it, that draw value from it. And I think that has real implications for the question of what is to be done, because I think the question is not simply to socialize the data commons or to assert our ownership, whether individual or social, over existing data. We actually have to move upstream and interrogate and reorganize the structures that are creating that data in the first place. I'll pause there because I went a little
Thank
over
you, Ben.
Earlier.
Sorry, I was busy taking more questions on my phone. So, thanks again, Ben. I'm going to come back to you now, Vahini. As you were talking, you know, I was thinking, okay, you know, we can see the direction of travel at the WTO, at least as the sort of as the negotiations were framed early on, notwithstanding the achievements that you and other like-minded states may have had in pushing back on that. But I was wondering, you know, what would a progressive global framework in this space look like, right? One that would be protective rather than pro-corporate. And then I would sort of augment that with a question from the floor, which said, you know, can countries achieve digital sovereignty? And what would that look like, I guess, in that context? And then a final last minute question that came to you, and I'll appreciate you haven't got long, and I'll let you choose which ones you're going to take. What, and maybe you've already sort of partly answered this, but maybe you'd like to elaborate a little more. What are the dangers of the plurilateral discussions on e-commerce that are going on at the WTO, and will this lead to further deregulation that favours big tech? So I'll hand over to you again there, Vahini. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ben. Thank you to the panelists and to the participants for the questions. There are so many dangers, you know, I think I had briefly touched upon it, but I would also encourage participants to look at some of the links that I shared. It does give a deeper analytical and policy perspective of why some of the rules that are being proposed would be extremely problematic for developing countries. Very briefly, the pandemic has really revealed a lot of deep structural vulnerabilities in the global economy, and we are now seeing and we have been seeing even before the pandemic, this move towards consuming locally and producing more within a nation's borders on account of environmental considerations, amongst other things. But perhaps it's also an opportunity now to begin to look at how developing countries and the global South can develop their domestic industries, especially in terms of the digital economy. You know, with the exception of China, I think there are no other developing countries who are even close to achieving the mass scale digital industrialization successes that have come out of the deliberate state interventions by the Chinese government. In terms of data, I think, you know, the biggest issue now in the WTO is whether members are going to agree to this unfettered cross-border data flows. And in our view, as I mentioned earlier, it is extremely premature to impose these kinds of rules, especially when so much is not known. We think that international engagement for now should really focus on experience sharing, analysis, dialogue, and maybe even cooperation in some areas. I also want to point out, and I think I've already emphasized, the importance of retaining policy space. You know, the problem with WTO rules is that it's legally binding on member states. And so developing countries should be able to retain their policy space and have and they should be allowed to develop and implement policies where we have the room and flexibility to change them, tweak them, and in some cases, even abolish them. There is an interesting cyber law tracker that UNCTAD has done, which has shown just how that basically shows the levels of uptake of legislation in cybersecurity, in electronic transactions, in data legislation. And in Africa, for example, only 50% of African countries have legislation on privacy and data protection. 72% of African countries have cybercrime legislation, even though from an implementation point of view, it's very, very low. So I think more needs to be done in terms of having policies that recognize the sovereignty of national data. You know, one of the rules that's being proposed is on the localization of data. And they kind of say that, you know, if data is located outside the national boundaries, you still may not have access to it because you don't own it. So the point I'm trying to make is that the localization of data is very crucial, because if data is located outside the national boundaries, even if a country has access to it and controls it, it can't stop others from having access to the data. For example, countries that own the cloud. And so there is no level playing field in this area. And I think in the context of a growing digital and technological divide, foreign firms will have a much higher capacity to use this data and form these digitally intelligent products to be sold back to you. And finally, I think I just want to point out the revenue perspective. You know, we're seeing that the EU is taking the lead here, you know, in trying to tax the digital activities by big tech. And we should also begin to look at how these digital activities by big tech can contribute to developing countries' tax base. And these range from, for example, the customs duties moratorium on e-commerce. And I encourage participants to look up the UNCTAD study that was prepared by the Globalization and Development Strategies Division on just how severe the revenue losses are facing developing countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Vahini. Now I'd like to come back to Anita. I think the question for you is quite straightforward, building on your previous presentation. You know, what would this kind of new settlement that simultaneously, you know, began to enhance our data rights, however we conceive those, while sort of pushing back and reining in the power of big tech, what does that start to look like for you?
Thanks. I'd first like to respond to what Ben Turnoff said about all of this not being really about data that is floating around, but it's actually about the infrastructures. I completely agree with you on that, but I think that reclaiming the data commons is not only about the rhetoric. I think that from where, you know, one may be located as a US citizen, for instance, you know, my battles are very, very different vis-a-vis the tech giants than if I were to be located, like Nanjira said, in a different part of the world. I hear you, Nanjira, in terms of the entanglement of people with the current infrastructures, but I do want to say that, okay, well, it's all gone, it's lost, let's cede more ground. You know, that's never going to be an answer. So the good news is that big tech concentration has met with increasing disapproval in the past couple of years. And even in the GDPR, we had an idea of self-determination and sovereignty limiting the kind of data that could be collected by platforms. But this, of course, evidently has not mended the platform economy, because informed consent, as we know, is the third fake news. It's a blunt instrument and it amounts to nothing. Then there have been other measures. You know, we had Elizabeth Warren's proposal to designate certain platform infrastructure as essential utility. Legal scholars in the US have recommended a structural separation of platforms and commerce. So you cannot operate a platform and market your own goods and services on it. And at least 10 countries have introduced digital services tax proposals. And of course, the US is hopping mad about it. Google was ordered by the French antitrust regulators to remunerate press publishers. But what's becoming increasingly clear that is in dealing with market failures of big tech power, not just market failures, these are economic catastrophes through these instruments, is not always feasible. If you're a small country, you will anyway be browbeaten to sign up into the new e-commerce trade deals. Secondly, these instruments do not take care of the value question satisfactorily. That is, the incentive structures of the digital behemoths. They will just pay the tax and write it off as cost to company and get on with the business of data theft and its various positive externalities for colonizing the planet. So how do you take back from the colonizers who've already built profitable and empires with the raw material from your soil, their intelligence capital? So at IT for Change, we've been looking at the need to create a distance between each of the major functions or layers of the data economy. The data collector or holder cannot also build and operate cloud infrastructure and provide AI services and put a finger in every economic sector. To give you an example, Amazon cannot sell stuff and process the data of its consumers and provide its AWS services, Amazon Web Services, to all other businesses and buy up Whole Foods and PillPack Pharmacy, which it did. You know, it wants to be in the health sector business. But even with all these proposals, the business of building an equitable and fair digital economy remains. And the question is not to just say, oh my God, you know, data is not floating around, it's all gone, what do we do? Regulation can help, but to create just and fair economies, we need to free up data power and intelligence capital for economic, social, and public value all over the world. I'd like my last, my slide to make the last 30-second pitch. The EU has come up in February with this fancy plan. It's called the Data Strategy, and it's all about various ways by which to take back data power. And I would like to say that in this particular instantiation of a common property regime for data, we'd like to propose that countries, in addition to principles of sovereignty, also complement their regulatory and legislative framework with economic rights about data. This is really important because sovereignty alone is not going to go all the way. We really need to actually complement sovereignty with economic power and define community ownership rights in data. And community ownership rights in data can be about access that a community has to data, the benefit extraction possibilities through use and licensing. Yes, I'm finishing. No, I'm just done. And on the defensive rights, you need boundary management. Because like Eleanor Ostrom pointed out, the tragedy of the commons always arises because you don't govern the commons. So you need to know who is out and you need restitution for damages. You should be able to reappropriate rights, just like the municipality of Barcelona or Amsterdam, where you tell Uber, if you want to operate on my streets, you better share the data with the public authorities. There will always be conflicting rights. There will be individual sovereignty, contractual claims, and public interest claims. But that's the business of a data governance authority to manage through nested sovereignty principles, an independent data authority that deals with the data economy, not only the personal data rights. And this can be effectively managed through data trusts. Thank you.
Thank you, Anita. A whole lot of stuff in terms of practical proposals there, and I'd encourage people to check out the links to the stuff that IT for Change has produced to get further into that. I want to come back now to Caroline. There was a question for you from the floor, and that was, how can we challenge corporate capture of citizen data without falling into the trap of authoritarian government control? And apparently the person asked this question because they're thinking about government-led data projects in urban planning. And I think you've touched on some of this, how, you know, every big data beneficial project also has a potential dual use and a surveillance underbelly. So maybe you could talk a bit about how you guys are negotiating that in City of Amsterdam or with other projects you've been with. And then if a question hadn't come from the floor, I was going to ask you, maybe you can give us an example of the thing you're most proud of that the City of Amsterdam has done in terms of, the way it's using data or is planning to use data. Maybe there's something specific you'd like to point to for inspiration. So I'll hand back to you there.
Sorry, I have to start again. Yeah, it's not easy. And I have seen taking the big companies taking over the world for 40 years now. And we try many ways, the WTH negotiations. As a city, we have no agency. In all the trade agreements, they define, like I tried, for example, to make a territorial claim for Amsterdam with the big companies to say, listen, these are data you extract from our territory, so they're from us. You have to at least to share, like what we did with Uber. It's very complex because there are trade agreements and we play no role as a city. So locality, while it's very important for data, they always come from somewhere and they go somewhere. It's like not accepted, not agreed upon. On the other hand, data is very important against corruption. Data is very important for transparency. Data is, so for example, we have big issues in the Netherlands with, as you know, with companies who have mailboxes who try to get the money here and not pay the taxes. And if we try between different countries to share our information to be able to tackle this, then we, even on the level of the public registry, we don't have the same kind of data sources. So it's very hard also. There's also a lot of things not working in the data world. So it's very complex. What I found very interesting is that we have a deputy mayor who said, let's just go back to the basics. And for example, she said, the basics is that I am entitled to walk through the streets without being filmed. Let's just make that our starting point. And of course, everyone says, how can you do this? Because there are hundreds of cameras in the city. She says, no, the starting point is that it's not normal to be filmed. You're entitled to just walk the streets freely. We are a free country. And so because she made this position and it was accepted by the council, now you have certain streets and it gives you a sign. If you enter into the street, you know you will be filmed. So if you don't want to be filmed, you walk around it. I mean to say there is not one solution. And I'm now working with the municipality because I feel that regulations, you can be very cynical about something like GDPR. We have been fighting for 30 years to get it, and I'm really happy that it's there. It's not good enough. It could be much better. It's also excluding certain things and not including others, but there's at least a first barrier that they were just running over us. So that I like. I see that, I think we give away way too much in imagination. So I think that the statisticians and the people who do econometry, so the people who do the data flapping, they are often working in a very mundane way, making huge claims about truth that they really can't back up. I think we really lack the arts in the whole data scene. We need good visualizations that empower people instead of baffling them with schemes that no one understands. So I think that it's a very not grown up world. And it's a classical Wild West. They just run in there to get as much as they can. I mean, early 90s, I had a letter from Bill Gates personally. If we could just give the copyrights of all the art museums of the Netherlands, then he would make sure they would be digitized. They just only give the copyright to me. I mean, even that you can have no shame to ask a question like that. So we are still in Wild West country, and it's very important to be aware of who has access to what data and where. And I understand completely that WhatsApp and mobile phones is for most of the people, that's the internet. But then let's make sure that WhatsApp has to behave in certain ways, that is not used to arrest young people who protest or who do the thing they want to do. So I feel it's very important to go. I spend a lot of time on the justice side of things, and we need to bring the titans under democratic law, and they are not at the moment. Whatever democratic law may mean, but it has to be addressable, accountable. We have to accept responsibility. We have to be able to say, this is not okay. And you have to be able to go to a court and win from them. So the right to redress and the right to personal sovereignty in whatever it is, in all the interdependencies that we have.
Thank you, Carolyn. We've got about 5 minutes left for Nanjira. Nanjira, I'd invite you again to just, you know, to reflect on anything that you've heard. We did get a couple of questions for the floor for you. One, I guess, kind of builds on the question we asked to Carolyn, which is, corporations, it's clear corporations don't have our best interests at heart, but this question is suggesting that governments don't have our best interests at heart either. And I think, you know, Carolyn very much touched on that. How can, you know, we as users reclaim our data in the middle of those, or sitting somewhere between those things? The second question was, how can we hold big tech to account for its role in promoting violence internationally? And I guess that means the sort of, you know, allowing their platforms to be used by those who we've seen are promoting violence. So over to you, Nanjira.
Yeah, maybe I'll complicate them as opposed to trying to answer them, because these are existential questions these days. I think, first of all, we do need to acknowledge that, and I think the moment we're in the world today is showing that there's discontent, and different people are showing different ways to push back against these onslaughts that are coming from so many fronts. The role of these companies in promoting violence, we have all these conventions, we have all these international platforms that need to be turned into action, simple as that. So we can't have, especially at the, you know, it's this unholy marriage really that we're seeing between the systems of governance and these corporations. And they in turn stand to tell us, no, don't bring the rules, or they'll call for the rules to work for them the way they want. Because if we actually put legal systems to work, they will work for the citizens as they were initially envisioned to. But now they've come for the spaces of lawmaking. Governments are caught up in their own madness, really. And these people are essentially ceding the ground that they're supposed to stand in for citizens. So what typically happens is we find our citizens were left just to take to the streets, and then COVID happens and we can't just take to the streets. We have to go to the same platforms and feed them our data and make them more money in our name of protest. But it's this iterative circle. We keep finding fissures, really, to keep complicating the equation. But I think as this world of COVID, Black Lives Matter movements, and wonderful complication that it all is, if we can emerge from that by saying we have to absolutely start reclaiming government and governance spaces to actually use them to support and represent citizens, I think we could get a win. I'm not about to prescribe any strategies. That's going to look very different. In some countries, you might find there's one law, you know, you just take it to the courts and surprisingly, the judge on that day whimsically agreed to follow the law. It might be that way. We just have to accept that there'll be a new toolkit. It is a varied toolkit. We can't say there's a one size fits all. And we're now really having these digital issues becoming joining the long list of existential issues for so many people. So I think keeping hope alive and getting creative and strategic is one way we'll do it. I hope that we will not always have to be reactionary. If we can, you know, let me in conclusion just even speak again about the international space, its counterpart in the UN and the intergovernmental internationals, really, the criminal, you know, criminal systems that we have internationalized. If we can start getting some processes pushed there, I think we might start making some avenues to complicate what's already happening in this unholy marriage between corporations and governments. Just to say, we shouldn't lose hope. I think there's still every day across the world we're seeing a new strategy that could have a catalytic effect, could have a domino effect. So it's just keep on keeping on that will get us to hopefully a point of prosperity.
Thank you, Nanjira. And it's great, as always, with these kinds of events to finish on an optimistic note. And of course, you know, we have got to remain optimistic. I'm not going to try to sum up what's been said, but I think, you know, I guess as you were talking, Nanjira, just, you know, as a way to sort of finish this, it is, you know, it's what is it that we have? What is it that we have, you know, in the existing toolbox that just needs to be applied to the online technological world? And I think, you know, for a lot of these questions, there are things that have been done to tame transnational capitalism, or to seek to tame transnational capitalism in offline spaces, that can be applied to the online world. But similarly, it's clear that there are things that are unique about cyberspace and digital infrastructure that do require the kinds of innovative thinking that Anita and the other panelists have put forward. So with that, I just want to say a huge thanks again to our five panelists. I want to thank everybody involved in organizing this webinar, all of the staff at TNI, Anita and Nandini from IT for Change, the interpreters, our co-sponsors, the JustNet Coalition, AIDC, and Focus on the Global South. We have a number of webinars coming up that we're either organizing or co-sponsoring this Friday. That's the 12th of June at the same time, 4 p.m. We have a great panel of speakers from movements in North Africa and West Asia, reflecting on the ways that the Arab Spring lives on and the prospects of a second wave of protests in the wake of COVID-19. And you can register using the link in the chat. And we're also co-sponsoring two mini-series led by our friends at the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, one focused on the Green New Deal and the other on trade policies. And you can see details of their next two webinars here via the link in the chat. We're also co-sponsoring a series organized by SOMO on the urgency of changing our financial system in the wake of the pandemic. Again, a link in our chat. And last but not least, our next Wednesday webinar will be Walls Must Fall, Ending Border Militarization. which will focus on the impact of the pandemic on border policy, and it's going to include Harsha Walia, Todd Miller, and other migrant and refugee activist leaders. And you can sign up again via the link that's in the chat now. If you'd like to stay in touch with the Transnational Institute, please subscribe to our newsletter. And also, if you are in a position to give, please consider a donation, as this allows us to provide these webinars and other publications for free. And you can donate via our website. We're going to keep the chat open for an extra 5 minutes so you can conclude your conversations there. Once again, thanks to all of our panelists. Thanks to you all for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.